Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast, the podcast that comes after Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
And Brian Mad Dog Brushwood.
Oh, they call me Brian MD for short.
Oh, man. I already got my gimmick.
Sorry, man. I went to medical school.
You got to live up to it. So, gentlemen, you know, there is a person who I think is a very fascinating entertainer. He's an extremely talented comedian, actor, who I think has been pushing the envelope. We'll forget the fact that he was the director of Pootie Tang. And
remember,
I'm talking about
Louis
C.K.
And celebrate him as the director of Pootie Tang.
Yes. So he has done some very ambitious things. Like he took, you know, he released an entire, you know, comedy special on his website for like $5 and it was a huge success. He's then tried, I think, to replicate that to some extent with other comedians and all that, but I don't think it's quite worked. I won't say that it didn't work as well, but I don't think it had the same degree. And then he decided to try, I think it was a very, very brave thing, and that was he created a TV show called Horace and Pete. We call it a TV show because we don't have better words for it. And it's starred him, cast including Steve Buscemi and a bunch of others. And he decided to, he did it a surprise, he paid for it out of pocket, shot this thing, and then unleashed it on the world, basically on his website and an email, says, hey, I've got this thing called Horace and Pete, come and get it. It's like, I think $5 an episode or something like that. It was sort of this pricing structure that was a little bit interesting. And by accounts of reviews of people who've watched this, a lot of critics praised this thing, thought it was very deep, very, very well done. He got a lot of accolades for it, but its sales wasn't there. And he's, you know, $5 million invested in this or some ridiculous sum of money. Not really ridiculous when you compare TV budgets, but still for him to personally have staked this money was a big spend. And so he was on Howard Stern talking about the fact like, this thing's put me millions of dollars in debt, you know, and this is an experiment, but, you know, people didn't show up for it, etc. And, you know, probably from, I'm curious to know what's happened since then, because I think that got a lot of attention to it. It put it on people's radar. And gentlemen, are you familiar with this? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah, sure.
I am. And I actually listened to another interview with him where he kind of went more into depth on where he felt what he said on Howard Stern was misinterpreted.
Yeah, he's not broke. Yeah.
No, certainly not. And what he was saying, and so I haven't heard the Howard Stern interview, but apparently is more clear in the context of, you know, they were talking about how he turns down a lot of stuff that Howard personally would have taken, specifically commercial stuff, and for whatever reason Louis C.K. doesn't want to take it, and so Howard was making fun of him for not, and so when the idea of like, oh, I'm millions of dollars in debt, like that's where, in the context of that, that's where that was. He says that he is in debt on the project,
right,
but that is not necessarily something that was outside of the plan for him, and it wasn't a surprise at this stage that really this is, and as you pointed out, like just the beginning of its life to the wider world. And everything else that we've seen up till this point was the idea that just him selling it to his audience, and there, you know, it was meant to be 10 episodes, and apparently in episode 10 has a ending to it, so it wasn't like he made 10 and then ran out of money and stopped doing it. But his plan is to take this and sell it to a streaming service, and that's like the goal of this period of it, to hear him tell it, was to make back whatever he could on it episode by episode, and then build up hype and critical acclaim to, at which he's been fairly successful at, to basically run it as an award an award season favorite when that comes around, and then sell it to, like, he was mentioning more streaming services than television networks, like Hulu or Vimeo or Netflix or something. And where I think that's interesting and smart is that he could package that as part of further involvement, further Louis C.K. involvement with whoever he makes a deal with, which I think is, he didn't spell out specifically, but I think could be something that if he wanted to do, he could do.
I think, and that's, it's such an interesting point in time because, like, yeah, I mean, you read the initial reports are like, ah, you know, he's going to be panhandling on the street because he bet it all. It's like, it's Louis C.K. I mean, this guy, you know, he's going to be fine, and he has a bigger plan towards it. But I would say that it was from his interviews, so it clearly didn't get as have the kind of traction that he hoped for initially, which may have to deal with, I don't know, there's not even a single trailer for it on his website. It's still a very interesting, you know, the age that we live in, because I think the thing that can kind of get easily lost is that, like, oh, was success or was it a failure? Is that, you know, here's a comedian who just dropped $5 million on his own TV series that he can have a first life on the internet and then maybe flip it to Netflix or somewhere else like that. And it's, you know, we talked about this ages and ages and ages ago about how the age of the producer is the creator, really becomes, you know, is coming about to some degree, and not always easily at first. And there's going to be a lot of missteps. You know, when J.K. Rowling, they launched Pottermore, you know, they wanted to create this environment where that was the only place you could get the Harry Potter books. It was going to be this, you know, big, vibrant online community for Harry Potter fans, but it probably came 5 years too late. And, you know, they then made, you know, deals to have those books, you know, available elsewhere. Yeah. But clearly Potter is a very, very big property. You talk to anybody who goes to Universal Studios, either in Orlando or here, and they tell you, you know, it's packed. It's huge. You know, we're getting a new movie coming out, you know, set in that universe. We're going to get The Cursed Child is going to be released as a book and as a play. So there's certainly a tremendous amount of life to that, you know, enterprise. It's just how you shape these things is what's curious.
Well, talking about shaping things, I am really, really shocked at the what seems to me a fairly sloppy use of language. Like, I don't know who was the first to say the phrase, I'm millions of dollars in debt. I guess Louis C.K. said it. If he said it, that was an astonishingly poor choice of words, because the fact is he spent money that he had with the hopes of getting a bigger return, and as of yet, the investment he made has not yet proven profitable. That's like, it's the equivalent of, like, if I were to cash out a 401k or whatever and spend $50,000 on Tesla stock, I wouldn't say, you know, if Tesla stock didn't move overnight or didn't do as well as I wanted it to, I wouldn't say I'm now $50,000 in debt. I would say my investment has yet to pay off in this regard.
He said he took out a credit line to finance this, though.
So but that's fine. He took it out against existing assets, though. He's not in debt. I mean,
he owes somebody $5 million.
I guess. I don't know.
Oh, it's, yeah. So on, and the interview that I'm referring to is interview with Bill Simmons on the Bill Simmons podcast. He says that based on how it is selling now, he will be paid off in his credit line by the summer, which he says is a success compared to, because he has participation in Louis' profits with FX, that, like, those projects, and you know, who knows how weird that accounting is, that those projects, like a season of Louis, stays in debt far longer than he will stay in debt for this one. I guess where we get weird is the idea that, you know, he is referring to himself as he in multiple entities. There is the producer for Horace and Pete. There is Louis C.K. the comedian, and there is Louis C.K. the writer. And there are boundaries there, although how firm they are, no.
I very much think it's going to be a success. I think it's going to probably be, as a percentage, far financially speaking, probably more successful than most TV shows are. Not maybe overall gross, but as a percentage of what he put in, what he'll get out of. Absolutely believe that. But I do. I would say, Samantha, like, no, when you take out a credit line, that's debt. Doesn't mean it's a bad idea, but it's still debt. You know, somebody has a debt note that says you owe this, and he's going to pay it off by summer. So, you know,
Ew. Yeah. But I think it's really, really interesting because I mean, ultimately, he's the one who took this risk, right? He's the one who went out and did it exactly how he wanted to do it. And we can look at that and say, and that is an instinct for which I am willing to admit I am fully capable of looking at the efforts of other people and saying, yeah, but this is how they should have done it, right? And sometimes that is healthy and good in that it helps think and visualize of how you will handle your own projects. And sometimes that is negative in that you are thinking more about the criticism of others than you are thinking about the furthering of yourself. But I definitely think, you know, Andrew and I were emailing back and forth about this a little bit this week. And one of the things that I said is that up till the entire 10 episodes were out and he was putting them out week by week, you had to get out your credit card and pay for each episode week by week. And I'm like, if you do that, you hate your fans. Like, you, if somebody asked me to do that and spend, like, not a auto recur, like, just like, yeah, no, get out your credit card and pay for the next episode every week. Like, I would be annoyed by that.
See, you think it, regardless of how good the quality of the content is, you feel like it was an inherently flawed rollout or distribution.
Oh, no, I mean, I think that would be a point in which I would say, hey, listen, I'm not going to tell you how many episodes there are of this. You can cancel at any point, but this is just going to auto-recur. If you click on this, it'll be an auto-recurring payment, and you don't have to get your episodes, and I'll just email you the episodes each week when it uploads, yeah, right?
I, you know, armchair wise, can sit there and take apart a lot of the ways he did the rollout and a lot of what he did that. I will give him credit, one, for being a guy that's putting his money where his mouth is and doing that. And two, it still gets me to this day, and this happened maybe 15 years ago when Stephen King did The Plant.
Uh-huh. Where he said, pay what you want.
Well, it started off like, yeah, pay what you want, but I expect it to be, this is what I think is fair, and you could download it and you don't have to pay me anything, but his plan was that people would pay for installments of the story. And then people started downloading the first few episodes, and then it started to decline. And then this was 16 years ago. And then what happened was a lot of the downloads were people weren't paying for them. And he got frustrated and said, all right, I'm ending this right now, and I won't release it till later on. So it took him a long time before he finally released The Plant. As you can see on his website, he finally gave it away. But if you're one of those people like, I don't know, me, who was buying it, and then all of a sudden he says, oh, too many of you are, you know, not paying for this, I'm stopping this experiment. But that was punishing. You know, that was really punishing your biggest fans.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, wait, I can't control those other people, yet you just took out your anger with him on me. And where Louis, in his weird sort of way, was like, well, I don't want to, you know, he didn't want to do like a package deal and all. I would say that it could probably use some evolving as far as his pricing strategy on it. But I think that he does have arguments for why he was trying to be fair in the way that he sees it.
And I think what is interesting is that Louis C.K., I believe with this project, and I haven't watched Horse and Pete, so I can't vouch for the quality, but critics that I enjoy have liked it. He did something that showed a clear difference of like, okay, well, let's really understand what a network, what a larger structure, what a platform can provide. Because, listen, it's real. You know, there are great benefits to being on a larger stage, and there are great benefits to being part of a larger corporation that has things like PR agents that are making sure that they call and get the same story and the same press release and the same press access planted in 50 different outlets, all timed to launch around the same 48-hour window. And yet, it's like, well, from a producer's perspective, if we only look at what Horace and Pete has done as just total bonus head start, both press and money, to then eventually lead to the very basic idea of just selling it to a streaming service, which happens 50,000 times a day, right? Considering how many streaming services are out there, then it's great, you know. Then we're to criticize it as anything other than a cool head start would be almost like missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah, I think that should he flip it to Netflix or Hulu, all the fans that he has that didn't buy it the first time are probably going to be curious to try it when it's out there.
Yeah. Well,
so do you think that in such a public way, presenting it this way, and whether it's deserved or not, it maybe has some kind of stink on it for having been quote unquote canceled or not successful or quote unquote leaving him in debt or whatever. Do you think that in any way affects what he'll be able to get for it from a Hulu or a Netflix or whatever?
I don't think so. I mean, I
think that the thing they're going to look at is the quality there, and is it has all this attention made it more interesting? If it pops up on Netflix, are people going to watch it? Are people going to want to go see it? And I think that in some markets, yeah, Brian, it might be. But, you know, for regular broadcast TV, I think that that would be a problematic thing, because it would be, oh, they're putting this failed internet thing here. But in streaming, it's a different world. All this brings me to the question I want to ask both of you.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a book, Station Breaker, right? Reviews on it been great. You know, it had a really good run of sales. I have not been pushing it, doing whatever I could, but it's done pretty good so far. Now it's, you know, doing a little happy, a little pace there, but not a great pace. And I could put money into doing things like right now, like go get pay like $600 to Kirkus to have Kirkus do a review, or go through the whole, you know, I can't do Publishers Weekly as a publisher because you got to do that 3 months before the book was published. Months before the book was published, it didn't exist. So doesn't quite work for me. But there are things that I could do to try to raise the awareness. I could send out, you know, I could print up 100 copies and send out review copies to bunches of reviewers and all that, and do that and try to do what every other publisher does to try to bring attention to something. It's an investment, and it's an investment that will take time. It'll take money that I could be spending on the next project. And the last time I was faced with this was, we'll say, first when I first did Angel Killer on my own, and then 3 months later, after I'm thinking maybe it's time to move on, it took off with, you know, surprising me. You both have really made big bets. Brian made a big bet launching Scam Stuff. You did it in a smart, strategic way. You know, you came up with an Indiegogo package where people could buy stuff, and you use that to then, you know, start this thing. But there was but it wasn't like they paid for everything. There was a considerable amount of time investment and economic investment on your part to launch this thing. What you did was get people involved early on to help do it. But that was a big bet. Sure. Justin with the Contender, you took a thing that was a by far and away a Kickstarter success, and your compatriots are now putting a hell of a lot of time and effort into launching this into a bigger thing. Your thoughts, your advice.
So, man, this is a really good question, because
thank you.
Because there's, whenever you launch something, there's different vectors. First of all, there's it's almost like a political campaign in that momentum matters. And, you know, you really do only get a single chance to make a first impression and so on. And the question is, how do you take something that's already out doing well, but needs to gain momentum to start that kind of landslide? I got to tell you, correct me if I'm wrong here, but The Martian was in a similar situation, right? It was originally self-published and originally was well received, but far from the landslide success that it became, or once it picked up momentum. I'm sure you've deconstructed. You could probably tell me the story of some of the stuff that Andy Weir did to help kick that.
I don't know what its traction was before Crown picked it up. You know, in my own experience with Angel Killer, that was a book that was selling in the hundreds of thousands of copies before HarperCollins picked it up. And that was, I put it out there. I did some tweaking and did something, you know, to that effect. But I didn't do, you know, a whole lot for it like there. And like, yeah, as Weir wrote a thing that he was serialized on his, you know, website and then put it out on Amazon at 99 cents, you know, and yeah, he did 35,000 copies in 3 months. Interesting, because like I'd sold, not to compare, like I sold over 100,000 copies of Angel Killer before I got a publishing deal.
Well, and also like Angel Killer had become a pocket smash hit in the UK. For whatever reason, that market really lit on fire.
Yeah,
for
and I did 35,000 in the US easily.
Yeah. Too.
So it's a curious sort of thing. And that obviously that book, now, you know, third book is sitting in front of me and the TV project is, you know, taking its own sweet TV time and it has a life of that.
Which, by the way, I absolutely adore the fact that that in the background, you know, stuff is simmering and brewing and happening. But meanwhile, the fact that you're already on to launching the next bet, you know, having these parallel projects is such the right smart way to do it.
Because, like, you know, when it comes time to promote the next Blackwood book, Jessica, I'm going to go full tilt on that. But meanwhile, you know, I watched what would happen in the magic industry, and Justin was, you know, saw a lot of this too. We knew the size of a magic industry was. We knew a product, you put out a magic trick, you'd sell maybe 300 or 400 copies if it was reasonably good to the collectors, and then maybe if it was, you know, had some momentum by that, you might do like 1,000 copies or whatever, and then that was kind of going to be it. There might be a little trickling sales. If it was a really, really successful product, like a really, really successful one that demoed great, magic shops and all that, then there would be this sort of jump to like 5,000 to 10,000 copies. I would have friends that would put out magic books, they'd put out a book or a magic product, and they'd sell like 300 copies, right? They take out an ad in Magic Magazine and Genie Magazine. They'd sell 300 copies right away. And they're like, well, I'm gonna take out more ads. And I'd be like, don't do it. Like,
right.
Well, what do you mean? I'm going to take out more ads. I'm like,
it's because you reached everyone with that first ad.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is they think that it's this much bigger market that they're going to get into, but it's a very small market. And you reached saturation very, very quickly. And so, you know, there's a point at which you can keep throwing money after something. And I told him, like, write the next book. Just write the next book. Not easy.
Well, so what do you feel like you've whittled down your attractive options to one or two? Because, I mean, again, there's doing some kind of giveaway or doing some kind of publicity stunt. I mean, that may seem a little bit crass, but you know, like that's certainly what I think of as P.T. Barnum style stuff, is figure out some big thing to do.
There are simple things I can do. Like, I can take, you know, I can take the book and I could have, like, you know, drop, you know, a couple thousand dollars and sending it, getting it reviewed in places where the big boys have their books reviewed. You know, I could do that. I haven't done a lot of playing around with price elasticity or whatever like that. You know, I know if I drop it down to 99 cents, it's going to jump up a bit, but I'm trying to, you know, get into this area. Like, I have How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours has been doing great at a $3.99 ebook, you know? And that's another thing, is like The Cure for Writer's Block, which is probably a better book, I haven't done anything to promote because, you know, I've been mines elsewhere. And so you get into that, how much time do I spend this? When do I make that bet? You know? I'm curious, like, you know, like, just how is The Contender going for you right now?
So The Contender's in a very weird place right now. I mean, and not weird. Like, it's picked up more momentum sales-wise on just the daily basis between our own website and Amazon. But we are at a point now where it's fairly clear that we are not going to get a lot of love from the tabletop community. You know, and selling party games to tabletop, like, connoisseurs, like people who are like super into tabletop, people that don't know us personally, like me or Brian or Andrew, that's always going to be a harder sell because party games are kind of looked down upon as just, you know, very simple mechanics, stupid games that, you know, writers who aren't really game designers create. And so now we're in the process of kind of, you know, being satisfied with whatever we were going to get there. And specifically, that was also tailored to our wholesale options and our, you know, just larger marketability within tabletop. Like, specifically, like, we were a finalist for the Will Wheaton Show tabletop. We didn't get that, which is disappointing, but, you know, whatever. You know, now the idea is, okay, so let's take that, take our energy that was focused on this more qualified, although smaller and more challenging niche, and let's now focus more on the kind of broader, are you just into having a good time and politics? Like the John Oliver crowd, right? And so that's what we've spent, which is a lot larger of an audience, right? But is not necessarily one that wants to buy a card game. You know, maybe they played Cards Against Humanity once and they either liked it or didn't like it. So what we've spent the last couple of weeks doing is trying to retool our social media and our own kind of outlook to be a little bit more that with the brand being we're funny and we're, you know, political, right? And that's the big difference between what we were thinking about before, which was like, hey, let's do live gameplay streams on Twitch. And like, you know, that's one community. The other community is like what we've been working on, which is a lot of these funny, shareable, viral videos and clips and stuff that's designed to kind of get out there. And that's what we're focusing on. But, you know, listen, I'm not going to lie. It's hard. It's mentally challenging and draining to keep your eye on the ball and be self-critical, but yet don't let it kind of get to you.
What one of the things I feel like the contender is one of the things you always want to do is have some reason to reach out to people about what's new related to the same thing. And in that regard, scam stuff is very fortunate because every single week we try to have a new release. If we don't have a new release, we have a particular contest or we have a new there's some organic reason to reach out about scam stuff every single week in an ongoing basis. For Station Breaker, that becomes a little more challenging. I do feel like on paper, the contender should have been, I'm using air quotes, it wouldn't have been surprising. If the contender was like most game releases, you would have had the announcement that it's Kickstarter, the announcement that you made it, and then maybe the announcement that you hit a stretch goal, and then that's it, right? But you guys have done a tremendous job of figuring out a way to, part of it is that it happens to be an election year, so it's a lot easier for you to come up with reasons why it's relevant for you to come back and show up in people's inbox feed over and over and over again. I wonder, some of the traditional things that you get to do with Station Breaker is, and I don't know how much of this interests you at all, Andrew, but it's like, you know, You can get on smaller media outlets to talk about anything newsworthy. Every time SpaceX does a thing, and or for example, like last week when they were talking about, or 2 weeks ago when we were talking about using light to, you know, push stuff to Alpha Centauri or whatever, you could have a take. Like the traditional author's route is to have a take, send out a press release. Author of science fiction, author, award winner of blank, star of this show, you know, has a counterpoint to, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson's opinion about blank or whatever. And then that gets you out there. And then that, you know, Station Breaker, in other words, you could kind of, without too much trouble, I think you could take the Weird Things show on the road out to other podcasts on the low end, you know, other media outlets like television on the higher end. And get the chance to plug your book because you have all the legit credentials at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree, Brian. That was, you know, kind of an early thing. We talk about it here. You know, the plan was, you know, to maybe do a separate YouTube just space sort of channel and do that. And those are things that, you know, when I find that, you know, it's deciding, okay, when do I dive into that? And kind of for me, it's kind of like, but right now I know that like, oh, I can write a check right now with, you know, a couple days worth of work. You know, have books out there and take and not have to spend weeks, you know, and I would like to do that kind of like speak more about space and stuff and those things. And part of the reason I wrote Station Breakers because it's kind of an excuse to be able to go do that. But to build up the credibility of the book, then maybe I need to go do things like, you know, what I saw with Angel Killer and Name of the Devil. Once I got those Kirkus starred reviews and it was a starred review, and now with Name of the Devil, if I may drop it again, finalist for the Thriller Award, you know, you see that credibility come into play.
To get back to your initial question of whether or not you should do it, I think it is worth it for you to do it. Not only because I think Station Breaker is a good enough and interesting and awesome novel that it has, like, it will warrant you putting the effort and therefore garnering the attention for it, but also because, you know, this is a pivotal book and much in the same way that I look at The Contender, that, you know, The Contender can underperform my wildest expectations, which is like, you know, two reprints and we always sell X amount each year with a bump for election years, right? Forever.
It basically becomes an annuity. It's like you wrote Monopoly and it just makes money forever.
Yeah, and we can undersell that. And let's say we just barely make back our initial big bet investment, which on one hand would be awesome that we sold X amount of games. On the other hand, would be a bummer that we're not, like, you know, rich enough to buy a boat. But at the end of the day, what I also have is now credibility as a game designer, as a tabletop game designer, as a party game designer. And you already have X amount of credibility as a published author, somebody who has done it independently, someone who has done it with a publisher. But this book, and I believe where you are right now as an author, I think would benefit very greatly from you having another independent published hit on your hands. And another one that goes from just your brain and your computer to being courted by publishers.
That's a really good point, because I do agree, because so much of momentum is the story. It's kind of like we were talking about, you know, what makes for a good ghost photo or whatever. That's part of what makes
a
for
ghost.
Well, that's part of what makes for a hit. I mean, a big part of why the Martian was such a compelling story to watch it ascend to become a movie and so on was because of that momentum. And I think Justin's 100% right, where it's like it absolutely clicks into your narrative to have, you know, to have this moment of releasing another independent hit and basically, you know, doing it all over again.
Well taken, gentlemen. Well taken.
But, you know, these are the kind of things that you need to think about, because very often I think you can very much frustrate and burn out your motivation by not knowing when the right spots are to kind of go all in, and the right spots are to say, all right, do I cut my losses here? Do I keep going? Do I continue to double down here? Is this just me putting in my own internal resistance because I'm being lazy, or is this the right decision for me to focus on something else? And it's hard, and very often you have to run down a lot of dead ends and realize they're dead ends before you realize, like, oh no, I know where this is going and I know what's going to happen here, and you make decisions, and even then you can be wrong on both sides.
You know,
do you put effort or do not put in effort?
One of the things I talk about in my book, the best-selling How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, is the creator's paradox, in that you get in the middle of a project and can always come up with a more attractive project you should jump ship to. When you encounter resistance and things get difficult, you're like, yeah, that's why I need to go work on this thing. And for me, I solved that problem for myself. I'm very good at finishing things. I've got a lot of finished things that are just sitting there, though, just sitting around. Like, you know, I think Justin and maybe Brian to some degree know how many unpublished novels I have that I just sit on. And because it's that, well, I can finish the book, but then to take it to the next step is, you know, and even it is the weakest part for me, because that's when it takes a lot of time and things are drawn out.
Which, by the way, I have nothing but mad respect for your ability to do. We were talking just the other day. Bonnie and I went to this meetup, and the question got brought up, like, what's your blind spot? And it was like, there was no hesitation for me to say finishing things. I love starting stuff. Not so good at finishing. I get to 80% and I'm like, the rest writes itself. I'm out.
Yeah, true. But I guess for me, the realization is that, you know, I finished the book, but then there's still, I can finish a book, make a finished looking book that people can hold in their hands and say, hey, here's a book. But like, you take, like, Care for Writer's Block, right? Blog. I've got like 5 reviews on this because I've not done anything to push or promote it, versus How to Write a Novella, which
that's interesting. Whereas
reviews.
like your defined finish line, like you did the same thing. The actual finish line is once you get it well reviewed and get it in the hands of a lot of people and get the word out on it, you're having a hard time with that last 20% on this.
Yeah, because I have done, again, I've been pushing the Humble Bundle and all that, and I haven't done anything to push this book, but here's a book that's better than this, the How to Write a Novella. I've done nothing other than an occasional tweet or whatever to sort of, hey guys, check this thing out. And that's one of the problems. It's like, I know the formula, I just haven't done the work.
Yeah, well, in that case, I don't have a lot of advice and or sympathy. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Everybody, Brian, you just totally turned on him. You're just like, well, F you.
Oh, no, well, by the way, that only comes from a place where it's like I'm so guilty of the exact same thing myself. And so if I can't give you a pass, you know, if I can't give myself a pass.
I mean, listen, there's a certain element to success that involves self-delusion. And I think this is partly where that comes in, is just saying like, hey, look, like this is a hard process to do. Listen, it's hard for me. It's hard for me to get up and think every day, what can I do today for the contender? Because between everything that I have done, everything that I thought I was going to do and then forgot about, and then I remember, and then I feel bad about the fact that I forgot it, every idea that I have that maybe is good or maybe isn't good, everything that's, you know, been done and didn't get the results that I wanted, do I try that again? Do, you know, like there's it's for a million different reasons, it sucks to get up and think about that. And then, you know, sometimes you just need that lovely opiate of delusion that like, hey, no, just go and do something because it's all going to work out fine. If you just keep moving.
Yeah.
Did I move the rock up the hill or did I let it fall back down?
Yeah. You know, and the more that you try to, I mean, there is one thing that I will definitely say, and this is something that I am very much guilty of, and some of you know, people that that I've known that are very, very talented have been afflicted by this, that, you know, you try to solve the problem in your head. And that's smart, that's strategic, to a point. When you try to make it a perfect shot in your head, it will almost always fail. Because either it's going to fail your expectations, or it's going to be something that isn't as reactive as it needs to be to what is actually happening out there in the world. And that is hard, you know? And it's very, 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 very discouraging when, like, you have to understand that maybe more effort doesn't necessarily, at least in your head, doesn't necessarily translate to more success, you know? Sometimes it is just the right persistent effort that you know, would do a better job. Is just go out, get out there, make a tweet, you know, put out an Instagram, make sure you reply to the comments, make sure you check the social media feeds, all that boring stuff, man. Like, the more it's there, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, there's that, you know, that problem. Like, I was a guy that always wanted to have the perfect plan in my head. I was going to, like, you know, figure out that one perfect single way to do it, you know, write one letter, make one phone call, and have everything fall into place. And you find out that could be a great idea, but
it's
that ain't
so messy though, because you could be 100% right, and then just that particular at bat it doesn't take, and then you could do the exact same thing again and have it hit a home run. I mean,
I deal with people too who are like, hey man, I had this idea 3 years before these other people did. I was sitting on a $1 billion idea. I'm like, no, you weren't. You know, billion-dollar ideas are free.
Yeah.
You know,
1,000 people had that idea, and, you know, 100 of those 1,000 people tried it, and out of those 100 people, 99 of them did it at the wrong time or with the wrong partner or in unfortunate circumstances.
Or most of them didn't even try. I guess mine was like, is it like they didn't even step foot out their door to make the thing happen? You know,
sure,
like
that's the vast majority. I'm saying that even the people who do everything right still. There's environmental conditions beyond your control about whether or not it hits. I swear, we were very lucky this past week in that our eighth or ninth episode of The Modern Rogue seems to have really taken off with the blogs, this how to create hallucinations. For the life of me, I cannot tell what's different about this episode from any other episode of Scam School, from any other episode of The Modern Rogue we've done. For whatever reason, it was just the right message that hit the right people at the right time, and it's done 500,000 views in the last 10 days.
I'll tell you. You can get high without drugs.
It's the title,
right? I think the title may have something to do with that.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? And then other times we do equally sensationalist titles, and then people just get angry and they vote it down, and they're all like, "Shut up, man! I didn't really get high." You know, it's a weird alchemy, and I can't claim to understand it. All I know is that maximizing your at bats gets you to that point of, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree, but I will tell you this, is that I have been constantly frustrated when I deal with other enterprises that
they go, we don't know, and they leave it at that. Not to say that you are, but I've had that where I've had like, and some things magically, algorithmically happen, but a lot of times you dig deeper, you find out this, like, I don't know why Angel Killer blew up like it did. I have no idea why it did. And we can say, oh, it's a great story. A lot of great stories out there.
Right.
I think that it probably had to do something with an Amazon recommendation algorithm. I think it had something to do with kind of a word of mouth thing. But I think there are probably some very objective reasons that are worth studying, because I think that you're absolutely right. Sometimes it's just random, but other times you find out, nope, there was this thing that you didn't realize that happened behind the scenes. And I found that out about a lot of books that, like, you find out, like, oh, these runaway successes. You find out, like, oh, yeah, you know, you think Twilight was a runaway? Well, guess what the publisher actually did?
Yeah.
Not to say that they did anything, but you find out that there are these things where you go, oh, you'll never replicate their success because you didn't know the thing that they did. And it wasn't being random. It was very methodical. Well,
and I guess that's my point, is we know what in the large scale works. For example, you know, the casino knows for a fact that its policy regarding how to play blackjack in the long term will yield 52% of the revenues going back to them. And they have the edge and they just want to maximize the amount of things they do. They don't know how any single hand of blackjack will go at any given time. They have a policy that in general works, and that's all they've got. And I guess that's what I'm saying. And so, you know, in that respect, even if you know you're doing everything right and it doesn't work out, just try to be more like the casino. Casino doesn't mope about its strategy. It just figures out how to get more traffic through.
And I think it's key to know when you are. Like, that's the frustrating thing about the traditional publishing industry, is they don't know why things work. And then the advice they'll give to writers, like, well, you know, just keep doing it. And well, after a time, it can take off. It's like, well, I can take that strategy, which is just to keep sitting down at the card game, or I can come up with my own game. That's been my attitude, is because, like, there's this just do this and it'll work sometimes. And it's like, well, maybe there are strategies that do help. You know, there are ways to game it,
and
which
there
are.
Definitely. When Hacking the System came out, I talked to one of the folks behind the scenes. I was like, okay, so what can I do on my end? And the answer was so unhelpful. It was like, oof. I mean, really, just just get a lot of people to watch. That's what it all boils down to, is you need a lot of people to watch it. And I was like, that's dumb. That's a dumb mission statement, because I can't control that. You know what I can't control is whether or not it becomes a trending Twitter hashtag, or whether or not it shows up in 12 media reviews or 3 media reviews. It's like, you know, that's the kind of thing, that's the needle you can move.
Yep. Gentlemen, this has been a very helpful, depressing, and illuminating discussion.
By the way, my pick is tonight's Game of Thrones.
We're not doing picks just yet, Brian. Uh-oh. Okay, we haven't started picks yet, which, by the way, mine would be Game of Thrones. What we are going to say is, if you have a business, a project, something you're working on, and you want us to talk about it, send it to us at...
Neshcom@gmail.com.
Use the subject line "After Things Weird Tank," and we'd be happy to provide you with our wonderfully helpful business expertise. I say sarcastically.
Yeah, wait, air quotes around all of that. Hey, Justin, do you have a pick this week?
Yeah, my pick is the game of the contender. it's Game of Thrones, man. I'm so excited for Game of Thrones. I had to tell Ashley that I wasn't going to watch it with her because she's in Boston and we're going to like barely pass each other to and from the airport tomorrow. And I'm not going to wait a week when I got to talk about it tomorrow on Hotline Monday. So I'm super pumped, man. I'm really excited. Like, and also this is the first episode since maybe the third episode that I hadn't read the books.
What comes next? Yeah. Well, that's just it. Like, to me, the show is finally beginning because we're in uncharted waters and everything. By the way, I do want to give a huge plug for Hotline Monday, and specifically I want to ask, cause I've been quietly tuning in here or there. Would it be weird for me to call in just on that line?
No, the goal is to do it. And what we really need to do is just get a special line, like just for our friends. To call in, because, I want, that's what I love. When we came up with the idea, that was part of it, was that like there would just be, it would be a soft way that all of our little network could chime in. Like anybody who just is into a thing or sees a movie, like, of course, obviously it's built on the audience talking about it and Scott and I talking about it. But if you want to just talk about Game of Thrones tomorrow, call in.
Heck yes.
But then also, I think, well, you know, and I don't know, and this is no, there are no spoilers here. But there's my favorite part of the new episode of Game of Thrones was where Ser Jorah Mormont was like, man, I'm really, really excited about the 2016 edition of the Contender expansion, and it's on pre-sale right now. So you can just go to thecontender.us and pre-order it. See, it says unavailable, but right under it, pre-order the 2016 expansion pack right now. Click on that. Bam, you have it in your life. I did final proofs on it yesterday. They're going to turn it around within 6 weeks, which means that within 2 months, everybody will have it, whether you pre-ordered it or you ordered it as part of the Kickstarter. This, by the way, is the biggest screw-up we did on this Kickstarter. I think we did a lot of stuff right. Here's the thing we did way wrong, and that is we have now, for some backers, done 4 mailings, which is just unacceptable.
Oh, just how much money you wasted on shipping stuff?
And time, effort, like, you know, and part of it was like if we building in the 2016 expansion was always going to be something that was going to be a separate mailing, but there were other mistakes that we did not have put together. And that would be the biggest thing, man, is like we did a really good job of thinking X far into the process. And then you're thinking like, all right, well, we got to the end of it. And no, what sweet summer children we were to not understand that, you know, there's you know, yet more. And so if we were to do it again, we would definitely think about it in a different way. But yeah, no, super, super excited for everybody to go ahead and get it. I think it's super fun, man. Some of the best cards that we've ever written are in that expansion. So if you like the game, go ahead and pick it up now.
Right on.
Sweet.
Gentlemen.
Yeah.
And after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.